Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, and I'm also going to say on behalf of the Onondaga Citizens League, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to today's program. We have a number of guests. For one thing, I did invite Onondaga Citizens League members, as well as other people who are involved in refugee resettlement in Syracuse, to today's program, because as you know, that's today's topic. And it is also going to be the launch or the pre-launch of OCL's 2012 study on refugee resettlement and how we might make Central New York an even more welcoming community. So that's going to be today's part of today's business. I wanted to give you a heads up about next week's program. Speaking of business, the title of next week's talk is The Business of Local Professional Sports. And in addition to Jeff Mickle, who's the sports director or the sports development director at the Syracuse Convention and Visitors Bureau, we're also going to have John Simone, general manager of Syracuse Chiefs, been in the news lately, Vance Letterman, who is the general manager of Syracuse Crunch Hockey, and Tommy Tanner, who is president and also head coach of the Syracuse Silver Knights soccer, for those of you like me who are not necessarily sports aficionados. But I think that's going to be a super interesting talk. We talk a lot here and in the community about how important arts and culture are to our community, and I would add into that category arts, culture, and certainly professional sports, and also other sports. Go SU. All right, so without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce the co-chair of this year's, one of the co-chairs of this year's study, Heidi Holtz. Where did Heidi go? Heidi is the director of project research and projects at the Gifford Foundation, a member of the OCL board, and along with Kristen Musatelli, he's a co-chair of the upcoming OCL study. Thanks, Heidi.
That's a long walk. Welcome, and thank you. As Sandra said, we are very excited about the 2012 study. The official name, I think, is probably being tweaked, but we do know it's probably going to start with the world at our doorstep and the opportunities and challenges of being a successful refugee resettlement community. And you'll be hearing much more about that, I'm sure, in the future. It is my honor to be introducing our speaker today. Peter Vogelaar is Executive Director of the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees in Utica, New York. It's a resettlement program affiliated with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. The Refugee Center is a homegrown program that is involved with the faith community of Utica from its inception. In the past 30 years, the center has successfully resettled nearly 14,000 refugees from 31 different nationalities into Utica. For a community of only 60,000, this is quite an achievement, and has earned Utica national and international recognition as, quote, the town that loves refugees. Peter holds a BA in history from Hope College and an MA in international development from Western Michigan University. Before coming to Utica, he lived and worked in the Middle East for nearly two decades. Peter, where are you? There you are. Peter Vogelaar.
Good morning. This is great. So you do this every week. You come together. That's fantastic. See, we can learn from each other, right? I don't think we do something like this in Utica, and maybe we ought to start doing something like this. This would be fantastic. Thank you, Heidi, for the introduction, and thank you for considering having us come and talk about Utica and the experience Utica has had with refugees over the many years. I understand some of you work with refugees already in the community. Can you raise your hand? I recognize a few of you there from some of the meetings we've been at. I want to set the stage for our conversation this morning by reading an excerpt from the 2007 Commission on Integration and Cohesion presented to the government in the United Kingdom. And then I have some prepared remarks, but then what I want to do is really have Q&A, some questions and answers I think would be most valuable for us to explore how things work in Utica, as well as kind of what's happening and creating the environment that Utica has been able to have in welcoming refugees. So I quote from the study, "Imagine the open communities of 2020, thriving and prosperous places where people from all different backgrounds are equal and where everyone matters, whether old or young, settled or new, black or white. There are local places where all groups feel that they are treated fairly, that they have a responsibility to others that transcends the differences between them. Places where people are not fearful of meeting their neighbors and where they don't see individual differences as a barrier to the success of the whole community. Imagine the local towns and villages where shared spaces, parks, community centers, villages, and estates are a reflection of what binds people together, where people have been inspired to get out and work together to solve problems, regenerating their physical spaces, or bringing young people together for shared activities that have resulted in a strong civic spirit. Imagine places where people are confident about change and the benefit it brings, who are not threatened by others, and who are able to welcome newcomers and offer them the support they need. Where people themselves are the catalyst for change in their local communities, working to bridge the gaps between groups and to mediate through tension and conflicts. Where people recognize that while there will always be difference, it need not always be divisive. Through the conversations they had as a commission, they saw that there is a way to get to their vision. They say the world is changing, the world is changing, but we can shape it. And if we take integration and cohesion seriously, and individuals together, if we take integration and cohesion seriously as institutions and individuals, together we can move from making difference important toward making an important difference." Let me read that last line again. If we take integration and cohesion seriously as institutions and as individuals, together we can move from making difference important toward making an important difference. Being from Syracuse, most of you have heard the story of Utica as told by the media over the past 30 years. A community that has faced economic and population decline, a community hit hard by an aging infrastructure and limited resources to update water mains, sewers, and roads, a community that required the National Guard at one point to help demolish abandoned houses so they wouldn't be burned down, a community with an aging population and youthful flight. We've all heard the same story over and over. But like the Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Adichie tells us, there is a danger to telling a single story. Quoted in the TED website, Adichie describes in her remarks how our lives and our cultures are composed of many overlapping stories. She tells the story of how she found her authentic cultural voice and warns that if we hear only a single story about another person or country or community, we risk critical misunderstanding. This morning, I want to tell you another story about Utica, a story about a town where refugees have found themselves not in a stressed community, but rather a declining one, a community where their skills have, where the refugee skills have provided a much-needed and new vitality. Refugees are resettled to the United States through a complex federal program, and I'm not going to get into all the details, but just give you a little bit of an overview. Each year, the President of the United States, in consultation with Congress, determines how many refugees from which region of the world will be resettled to the United States. The State Department is then tasked with implementing the program, and many national and international partners participate in helping approximately 7,000 men, women, and children relocate to the U.S. for new beginnings in our communities. National and local voluntary agencies across the country, some 400, including Buffalo, Rochester, here in Syracuse, Albany, and even in Utica, support and welcome new arrivals each year. In Utica, for 30 years, nearly 14,000 refugees from 31 different nationalities have come to call our community home. And as you heard earlier, in a city of 60,000, that's quite an amazing achievement. The refugee community has contributed to Utica in many, many different ways. They have purchased some 600 homes, and our best guess is that of that 600, 200 to 300 of them were tax defaults. Often these houses are in rundown area, and they've been able to put them back on the tax rolls and restore a lot of these properties. Block after block, homes have been resided, flowers planted, sidewalks cleaned, and taxes paid to the city and to the county. Community gardens have been started with Latino, African, Burmese, Bosnians, and others, with everyone benefiting. And in 2011, ABC News ranked Utica in the top 10 communities to purchase a home. Refugees have built their own businesses, which include insurance agencies, automotive repair centers, car dealerships, furniture stores, bakeries, groceries, construction companies, HVAC companies, landscaping companies, and some have become CNAs, and even doctors. We've seen people who went from being refugee resettled all the way through become doctors in the local hospitals. Asian restaurants are popping up throughout town, and a Bosnian restaurant owner recently won the coveted chicken riggy competition, an honor that's usually only bestowed upon, Italian eateries. And this past year, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle actually highlighted Utica as a culinary destination. It's got amazing food. Churches, mosques, and temples have opened around the town, and the school district in Utica is one of the only growing school districts in upstate New York. Some of you may have heard about a year ago when they opened the mosque in downtown Utica. Did you hear this whole story? While they're opening trying to put the Muslim Community Center in downtown New York, near Ground Zero, Utica, right down next to City Hall, there was an old dilapidated church that was falling apart, and the Bosnian Muslim community purchased the church, restored the facade, restored the interior of the church, drained the water that was a foot deep in the bottom, and transformed this church into a beautiful Eastern European-style mosque. And not a single complaint from the community, right? You didn't hear anyone complaining about it. And New York Times actually came up and did a story on this. It's like, how come you don't have a problem with this? And I think one of the reasons we didn't have a problem with it is that the Bosnian community in its relationship to Utica and the Utica community in its relationship to the Bosnians, they actually had a ceremony as they transformed this church. They had a ceremony that brought the congregation that used to call that the building home. And they sat together and they exchanged all the relics of the church and gave them back to the community. These are the kind of things, the relationships that we've built in Utica to make this work. A demographic study by Dr. Ellen Crayley at Colgate University showed that the population of Utica between 1990 and 2000, the population decline of Utica between 1990 and 2000 would have been about 20% without refugee arrivals. But in the 2010 census, Utica actually posted a population increase. They grew by about 2,000 people. Instead, between 1990 and 2000, with that census study, the population decline was only 11%. So that was a significant impact on our population. And the implications for the city are enormous. Had the decline gone unchecked, the city would have lost its automatic eligibility for state and federal aid, potentially. And some of you realize that work in that, in a world, if you drop below 50,000 people, you suddenly go into a whole different classification for state and federal aid. Refugees have increased participation in sports throughout the area with soccer, martial arts, basketball, volleyball, and other sports, offering young adults and families safe and secure extracurricular activities. The presence of the refugee immigrant community also and immigrant community creates job opportunities for the native-born community as well, whether it's in the county offices, the Department of Motor Vehicles, city government, grocery stores, gas stations, teaching jobs at the schools. Refugees have also been instrumental in enabling some businesses to remain viable in the community. In fact, some of the business leaders in the area were quoted as saying, without the refugee community, we would be dead in the water. The community of Utica is actively working to integrate the refugees and immigrant community into governance, city offices, police, fire, and the business community as well. Some of the leading businesses have actually hired some of the Bosnians because of their experience with Eastern Europe and used them to do sales in Eastern Europe and then go back and forth. And this has been a wonderful success for these companies. But I don't mean to imply that Utica's experience with the refugee community has been a fairy tale story. Like any place where a new kid has moved into the block, there have been many, many challenges. With the increase in housing occupancy, we've seen an increase in property values. The relevant cost of housing vis-a-vis income is making the community an increasingly costly place to live compared to what it was 10, 15 years ago. Our poverty rates are terrible, and many of the refugee arrivals, particularly the newer arrivals, fall into this category. The school district has struggled to keep up with the influx of limited English proficient students. 40 different languages are spoken in the classroom, and approximately 18% of the student body is LEP, limited English proficient, compared to the statewide average of 5%. Hospitals are required by New York State's Attorney General to provide linguistically appropriate healthcare services to the limited English proficient community with no cost reimbursement for interpreting services. We also have experienced some gang-style conflicts in the streets, largely between emerging immigrant and ethnic minority groups trying to vie for their identity and for the territory in the streets. And for some of Utica residents, the refugee is perceived as that, quote, damn foreigner who takes my job, gets handouts from the government, is given a car and a house, and doesn't pay taxes for 7 years, and I've heard them all. I can tell you they are rumors. They do pay taxes. They don't get a car. They don't get a house, right? The lowest hanging fruit of the complaint about my life, right, is the next newcomer who's come into the community. So in many cases, the refugee gets labeled as what some would call problem people. The reality is refugees have faced untold problems. Right, and they have transformed their lives. They are the survivors. They are the resilient ones who have been able to make it through incredibly tough times and come and create new opportunities and new lives. So there is a danger in telling a single story. Despite the challenges I just enumerated, and many others like them, Utica really has had amazing success integrating the refugee community. In 2005, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, their international publication called Refugees Magazine, exclaimed on its cover, "Utica, the town that loves refugees." This had a distribution in 15 languages worldwide. So why do I think Utica has had amazing success welcoming our newest neighbors and refugees? My interpretation is by no means scientific, but if someone wants to figure this out, I welcome them to do this. But it's more gut feeling from living in the community now for about 10 years. I believe it comes down to the following four characteristics of our community. First, the economic decline of the area is well known. GE closed, the Air Force Base closed, and light manufacturing started to move south and or overseas. Two, it wasn't long before the economic decline began to be outpaced by the population decline sometime in the mid-90s. We had a dearth of housing, jobs, and service providers. Enter the influx of more than 6,000 people starting in 1995, people who spoke limited English, were of a different socioeconomic background from the local population, were culturally different, and were predominantly Muslim. In 1997, we resettled 1,300 Bosnians in that 1 year alone, literally picking up busloads of people at the airport here in Syracuse on any given day. Landlords welcomed people who would occupy their properties because they were sitting empty. Employers were eager to fill unfilled jobs, and service providers had someone to actually serve. The average person on the street had to give up very, very, very little, or even nothing, to make room for this newest neighbor who is coming in. Third factor. Remember, Utica once had a population of over 100,000. The community services infrastructure, the Department of Social Services, county offices, employment services, etc., were all equipped to handle a much larger population. And fourth, and perhaps possibly the most important aspect of Utica, the most important characteristic of Utica, is that the people still identify with their immigrant past. The local community is predominantly made up of relatively recent immigrants, Poles, Irish, Arab, Italians, and others, and the Bosnian and Russian speakers that came in the 1990s, while Eastern European shared similar work ethic, family structures, educational goals, and the American dream. They were simply the next wave of immigrants and were considered to be welcome. I think given any other situation, a per capita population increase of this magnitude that we experienced in the 1990s in such a short period of time could have been a pressure cooker with catastrophe written all over it. The refugees, particularly the Bosnian refugees, were quickly viewed as what I've come to euphemistically call people with replacement value. And where were we as an agency throughout this experience? We were intensely focused on the work of helping the refugees begin their new lives in their new homes. We are what is called a one-stop shop. We have under one roof a robust set of services for refugees, including case management, employment assistance, vocational training, ESL, immigration, citizenship, and more. The list is a long laundry list of things that happen right in our center. Since the 1990s, the population decline has reversed and even grown with the last census. The economy, while still struggles, is more stable, and the housing market is increasingly full. Refugees are still coming at a much slower rate of only 400 to 500 people annually, and we've seen a significant growth in the Hispanic community to around 10% of the population. So combined, the new immigrant or the derivative of the new immigrant, the children of those new arrivals, are about 30% of the community today between the Hispanic and the refugee. With the stabilization of both the population and the economy, we must be much more conscientious of the environment in which we work. We began to ask ourselves at the center how we thought our community would perceive the newcomer when they could no longer be seen as replacement for lost population. Easily half of our work is with the local community. In the past 10 years, we have refocused our efforts to include helping our local community build the capacity to welcome refugees and immigrants, and to our own our future together through hard work, tolerance, and patience. This has taken on the form of professional interpreting services through our Compass programs, bridging language and culture, and delivering cultural competence training to police, fire, social service, hospitals, and a myriad of other providers in town. For example, a local bank, it's corporate as well, for a local bank wanted to recruit from the Bosnian community. We worked with them to identify what aspects of their hiring practices might be a barrier. The types of things we explored with them included policies for wearing the hijab in the workplace. Did they have a policy? Did they need a policy? What type of training would they need to handle a situation where a current customer comes in and refuses to be served by a veiled woman? How are you going to deal with that situation? We've consulted with an employer who established a refugee production line that is now actually outproducing every other line in the company. We have taught classes to the police department about the different cultural nuances of the Somali Bantu, the Karen, the Bhutanese, the Burmese, and many other ethnic groups. And this past fall, the Refugee Center with our local community, including many of the colleges and others, came together to share our experience with integrating refugees through our first annual film festival, human rights film festival, and a conference on integration called Unspoken. We actually had 70 community members participate as volunteers in the design and development of the program. And I invite you to it this October, too, this coming October. I approach my work at the center based on my educational training. I have a master's in international development, and I was trained to work myself out of a job by building the capacity of the people I was working with. At the center, we approach our work the same mindset, to build the capacity of our new neighbor and the capacity of our community to engage each other. So perhaps there is a fifth characteristic that explains why Utica has had success resettling refugees. And perhaps that characteristic is the 30-year story of the Mohawk Valley Resource Center for Refugees, whose single focus has been on helping refugees integrate and fostering the conditions that make for a welcoming environment. Remember, it's a two-way street, right? Integration of people is a two-way street. We both have to give up a little bit. We both have to adapt a little bit. It's a process that we work through. So I consider it an honor to participate in the welcome this country demonstrates to tens of thousands of refugees. The refugee program strengthens us, not just through our own character, but by economic growth and diversity, driven by highly motivated and capable new citizens. The resettlement programs are a valued national treasure, which revitalize local communities, boost economic activity and jobs, provide a powerful unifying success story, which can counter elements within the U.S. which focus on negativity and fear rather than productivity and trust. This is why we ask that you proactively work with us in Utica and our center and in your own community to help transform the U.S. into the nation of promise to the world we all want it to be, as enshrined in our Pledge of Allegiance, our Constitution, and more personally for me, on the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I left my lamp beside the door. Isn't that a wonderful way to close? Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Paul. Be right there. Wait for me.
Peter, I'd like you to comment. Here in Syracuse, we have the phenomenon of our high schools, not unusually, the top two spots, or one of the top two spots being refugee kids graduating, and see if that. And the other part is on the lower end, the entrance. The children are only given 1 year in which to master English, and then they have to sit for all the tests that are being held. And I think that's a tremendous burden on Syracuse School District, and I'm wondering how is Utica School District kind of wrestling with that particular handicap?
It is an issue. I mean, there's an expectation for, with No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, that the kids who come in the same school year will need to pass the Regents exam or whatever state, you know, administers exams that they have. And the reality is they can't do it. Very few can do. Some can, but it's very, very difficult for them to do. So the Utica School District struggles with this as well. And so I can't speak exactly, you know, for the Utica School District, but I know they have many different programs. They have lots of ESL teachers. They have lots of approach to try to help with the kids. But they struggle with the same issues. From our end, what I've tried to do is do some advocacy work around that issue, literally at the White House. I was at the White House last year. I was invited to a they have this Champions of Change program, and so I participated in that. And we brought up this issue at the White House, talking about how can you hold these schools accountable for this kind of love education. We don't want to diminish our work with the kids. We don't want to diminish the level of education that we're trying to give the refugee and the other immigrant kids. But we can't hold teachers, and we can't hold that child to be accountable at that, you know, to those state exams in that time frame. And so we actually, the White House, the Department of Education, who was sitting around the table, actually said that's on their radar screen and is a priority. Of course, a priority what out of what, right? Who knows? But at least they're aware of the situation. So I think, but what it requires is all of us around the table to continue that pressure, to put that pressure on, to make exceptions for that community. And again, you got to make the exception that doesn't downgrade the level of education that we try to provide the children, but puts the into a realistic perspective. Utica schools, but you know they're dinged a lot, partly because of the limited English or ELL English language learners. But it's a what they can demonstrate is their graduation rates after 5 years go through the roof. They're fine, but the graduation rate in 4 years really struggles. And part of that's that influx of kids that are coming in that age that are, you know, 14, 15 years old, getting them to graduate. They've never had a formal education. They've never gone to, you know, that's really a tough road to hoe. But they've demonstrated that they can do it given enough time and resources and you know, to get to that point. So how do we as community members advocate on their behalf? Because it's a win, you know, this can be a win-win, right? If we are able to figure out how to negotiate through that. I don't have an answer for you yet, but I know it is, you know, I think we all have to be a clear voice about that.
Marhaba. Shukran. I think that the speech that you gave could have been given in so many times throughout our history, and part of the problem with us, and Syracuse is also a community that I think identifies with its ethnic origins, but we forget. And OHA is working with a number of the different resettlement programs to help find a way where we can educate the existing population to show that the Irish and the Germans and the ethnic populations that we celebrate now and that we have festivals with and we enjoy the things that they provide to our community. Not too long ago, even, believe it or not, the Italians were vilified. And to show, you know, the headlines in the newspapers and other things that we can show from our history that people would look at now and say, how ridiculous. And to show that. And I was wondering how you and Utica have attempted to educate the existing population and to use history to show that this is nothing new. It's happened many, many times before, and these communities have been able to assimilate into the community and contribute in a tremendous way.
Right. And there's an investment that we as a community need to take on in their coming to us now so that they can in the future be that contributor. Absolutely. There's a great saying that's, that I've used many times. It's everyone's favorite immigrant is a grandmother. Anyone since then? Right? Their grandmother walked off the boat speaking English. Right? Their grandmother walked off the boat with a PhD. Their grandmother walked off the boat and made a living for themselves and had, you know, this is the story you hear all the time. We hear it in Utica all the time. And you do these kind of things here too. Just I think the dynamic of the size of the city obviously plays into this, but how do you get more people involved? We celebrate World Refugee Day, and we invite the community to come, and we get a significant portion of the community to come to World Refugee Day. It's June 20th every year. And we've actually, for a number of years, not the last couple of years, but for a number of years, we actually got the city to host World Refugee Day with us in Hanna Park, which is right outside the mayor's office. So there was a partnership between ourselves, the refugee community, and the city of Utica. Various reasons that hasn't happened. Unfortunately, the last couple of years it hasn't happened. But that's helping the leadership of the community, right? Our mayor, the business leaders say, this is an important aspect of who we are as a community. We need to invest in this and take ownership of it. So that's part of it. The newspaper, I can't tell you, I've had many, many times on first name basis with the editorial board, right? So we go and we talk with people at the editorial board. So we're always kind of helping frame that conversation. So they, you know, we look at watch what stories are coming through and we have an idea of what's happening there. So we're very, very intentional in our relationship with the media. We had the Boilermaker, you know, the Boilermaker, the road race. And we actually, in partnership with Mohawk Valley Community College, have a mile stretch of the Boilermaker that we try to highlight a lot of the different immigrant communities, not just refugee, but all of them together for through performances. So we get, you know, 14,000 people who come by and see kind of a little bit of the history of Utica. We're actually in the process of trying to apply for a grant to put a park in on Park Avenue in Utica that will highlight the immigrant history of Utica and be a place that everyone can come together. So we try to find those constant avenues where we don't want to, as a center, we don't want to be the centerpiece. That's not our job. Our job is to figure out how to get you and you talking together, and what is that environment, and how do we do that? Unspoken is another way of doing this, bringing people together through this film festival, through the conversation about integration. And we're not trying to whitewash them. We want to what are the challenges, and how do we work at this as a community to address it? So it's a very proactive relationship with the community that we try to constantly foster.
I've heard no discussion at all about two things. One is race and what the problems with race, how many black people were there. I heard you talk about the Bosnians, the Burmese, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about that race discrimination. That I'm sure it does exist. And the other one is the arts. And that is, you've got a wonderful museum over there, I know. And how you get your programs involved with some of the cultural experiences of the refugees.
Okay. Good questions. There are definitely race relation issues in the community, right? And I don't know what community in the United States doesn't have it, right? We all struggle with race relations. And we see those struggles not just with the white population, the black population, or the Hispanic population. We see that happening between the Burmese, Asians, and as a new emerging population with the African American or the Latino. So we see this in all sorts of dimensions in the community. I would love to say that we overcome these. We don't. But what we try to do is, again, here's an example. We have an organization in town who is predominantly African American, working with community gardens, community development, for the good, it's called. And what we've tried to do is get the Burmese community leadership and the leadership of that organization to come together and to sit down with each other and try to bridge their differences. Our role is the facilitator there. Our role is to try to get those two together to talk with each other, not be the center focal point of this. We work with the police department to bring in, because we are facing, part of it is just street smarts, right? It's kids figuring out how to live in the streets. Getting young Karen Burmese youth to sit down with the police department so the police department understands what their dynamic is and what they're facing, and then the police department to bring the African-American youth that they're working with and the Burmese youth together and to sit down and talk and work through some of these things together. And so it's a facilitated conversation. Do problems still exist? Absolutely. They're still there. But what we're trying to do is shed light on those problems and bring people together so they can talk to each other and figure out strategies to work with each other. We're not going to be the solution as an institution. They're going to be the solution, those people who are participating, or members of the community. So that's an ongoing struggle, and I don't have an answer for it. The arts is actually an unspoken. The Muncie Williams Proctor Art Institute participated in that with us. They did a program a while back. April Oswald is the director of education at the institute, and she saw this program in Chicago that she emulated in Utica, where they took the middle school kids and brought them to, as a part of a school project that were interested in the arts, brought them to the institute, brought in other kids that were not immigrant kids, and had them together look at some art pieces and put on a whole play based on this art piece. It was a great program. Because what we find, the soccer field is the perfect place, right, for bridging some of those gaps. The soccer field is where your value changes because now I'm the high scorer, right? So I'm the new immigrant, I just arrived, I'm the high scorer, and the kid who's been here, third generation American, you want the ball, go right ahead because you're going to help my team win. But not everyone plays soccer. So what are those other avenues for making that happen? And this is what we were trying to do with the arts, is say, well, let's get those kids who are artistic, who don't necessarily, they're isolated in their environment. Let's provide them with an access and relationship with another group of people so that their value begins to change and mold, and your value as a member of your community begins to change. And those are the kind of things that we ourselves as an institution can't do. We can't be all things to all people. But what we try to do is get other institutions to take on that role and to foster that kind of relationship. And so they've been a wonderful partner in that, actually, in trying to help make that happen. Other questions? I know someone down here had one. Okay.
Good morning. You mentioned the police department twice in your comments so far this morning, in an area that I have some unusual interest in. Who was bright enough to figure out the relationship the police were needed in the immigrant community? And can you give me a little bit of how that works?
Well,
You have to remember, we live in a smaller community, right? So we're on first name basis with the captain of the police and different individuals. We know them. They invite them into our institution as part of our cultural orientation program. We actually invite the police to come in and work on cultural orientation, so there's that awareness made. They've assigned people to work directly with us, the police department, and so we just completed a training, actually, where one of my Bosnian staff went in and talked about immigration-related issues with the police department and talked about who is the refugee, who is this kind of immigrant, what are those different types of immigration status they might have. But as part of that, she was able to infuse with them, right, and answer questions about some of the cultural differences and some of the cultural background. So we've had from the police department in Utica actually a really active, engaged, willing partner to learn what it is that they're, who the community is. And so that's been a great asset. And that comes all the way from the top, in the police department who have participated in that. And this has been a great, and then we have another person who does our cultural orientation who's been a dogged in that relationship. And so we now have, literally we had an issue once at the center a while back, and I was able to call a police officer and say, can you come, we don't want arrest me, but we want them to understand that the behavior that's being exhibited here is inappropriate. And so they were willing, an officer actually came down and sat down with them and helped diffuse the situation and make sure that the situation didn't become unmanageable for either the family that was being dealt with or ourselves. And what a great relationship for us to be able to, actually that was a cell phone call. That was to the individual cell phone call who then came down, managed to alter their schedule and come down and help us out with that. I mean, that's an invaluable relationship that we have.
Could you make a comment concerning the percentage of the immigrants who are Muslim? And if that has presented any special problem, because there's a lot of places in the world where they've become unpopular.
Well, for one thing, personally, that's dear to my heart. I grew up in the Middle East, spent 20 years in the Middle East. So we've actually had some sessions in Utica where my father actually is an Islamicist. His PhD is in Islamic studies. He's actually a pastor also, so it's kind of interesting. We've had some workshops. So he's come in and done some workshops. And bringing the two communities together to explore interfaith issues, Muslim-Christian and Jewish community issues. So that's something, and we're actually in the process of trying to reactivate a program like that to get that started. But I think a couple things they have to put into consider. Our experience, there are probably things that have led to us not having the angst. One is the Bosnians who have come are predominantly, while they're Muslim, they identify as Muslim. They make up we helped almost 5,000 people come through their families and everything else. They're probably close to 10% of the population. Of the Bosnian community in Utica, 98% of them are Muslim. So we have a significant Muslim population in Utica. But they're largely secular Muslim. So not a confrontational relationship that has been built around there. The mosque, the older, more established mosque in Utica, is very community-minded, very community-centered. We've worked with them to develop relationships throughout the community. In fact, a good friend of mine is an architect. He's working with them trying to find a new space and build a new building or renovate a new building. And no one seems to have a problem with it because the relationships that have been built are not predicated on whether you're a Muslim or a Christian. The relationships that have been built are predicated on you're a valuable asset to our community as a person, as an employee, as an employer, as a neighbor. That's what the relationships are predicated on. Their faith is secondary. And this has worked for us as a community. And the Muslim community is probably one of the highest concentrations, at least in the Northeast, in Utica. I mean, there's a large number of Muslims in Utica, and we've not had the problems, but I think it's because we have the conversation, we talk to each other, we communicate with each other, and we put first the value of you as a human being, secondly, the value of you as a religious person.
Good morning. I wonder who are some of the key champions that are creating some of this open community change in Utica, and by role, who are they in the formal network and maybe also in the informal community leadership?
Very good question. The leadership comes out of two ends, essentially. It comes out of the refugee themselves, who, you know, we have people that have run for office. We have people who are in the city governance. So they themselves are part of that leadership dimension that have tried to make their presence known in the community and have been accepted in that role as well. In fact, a previous mayor, two mayors ago, appointed a Bosnian to the Common Council when a seat came open. A lot of the leadership has actually come from our mayors and from the elected officials of the community who have embraced. And, you know, why they've embraced, I haven't necessarily pushed that question, but they have embraced, right, the refugee community that's coming. A lot of it, I think, goes back to that replacement value, right? They've seen the transformation of homes. They've seen the tax base increase. They've seen the property values. I mean, I know guys who bought houses for $13,000 and are selling them for $75,000. That doesn't sound like a lot, but you're moving it from a $13,000 tax base to a $75,000 tax base, right? That's they have seen that firsthand. They've seen the transformation of gardens and houses and refacing. So you can't help but appreciate what's happening. So that's one. That's really, we've had leadership from the very top saying it's okay, right? It may be passive, but it's okay. The other area we've seen a lot of leadership is from the business community, business owners, especially the larger employers who rely very heavily on, and they love the immigrant workforce, because many of the immigrant workforce come with what we, our ancestors, our grandparents, our parents came with, that work ethic. 2-3 jobs, work your tails off. You know, when you buy your house, you pay cash, right? When you buy your car, you pay cash. And we have a story of a Burmese, one of the first Karen Burmese families that came, and the pastor went with them to buy their first car, and they bought a Honda Odyssey. And the salesman said, well, how much are you going to put down? They said, $1,500. So he thought, $1,500. Now, they put down $15,000 in cash against a, $30,000 vehicle. The salesman was just like, whoa, okay, and they'd been in the country for about 4 years at that point. So they had been saving every single penny they possibly could to buy that car. And they've been a very successful family. So those business owners recognize that, and they embrace their work. We placed people in 400 jobs last year. We placed people in 400 jobs from as far away as Casanova to Amsterdam. Right, and they live in Utica, so they'll commute those distances. So that's where the other leadership comes from as well, as from the business folks. And so, in a sense, they're saying it's okay. This is who we are. This is who we are becoming. There are challenges. I talked to one business leader who actually said he was worried because he is a metal fabricating company. And he said, I look around who's working for me, and almost all of them are 50-year-old white guys. And in the next 10 to 15 years, they're all going to be retiring, or many of them are going to be retiring. And if I look at the community, who I'm going to be replacing them with, it's a very ethnically diverse pool of people. They often will speak languages different, right? Different languages at home. They look different than the guys I currently have on staff. And that's who my pool of employees is potentially going to be. And so, who I worry about? I don't worry about those guys that I'm going to be hiring. I'm actually more worried about the 50-year-old white guy who's sitting next to this other guy figuring out, how do I adapt myself to work with this, diversity that's coming into the workplace? And so that's the area where, again, we as a center have tried to engage the community and say, how can we be a resource to you to help, change that dynamic? Yet that manager saw the value of that person who was coming in to work for them. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Hi, this is a fascinating presentation, and I'm very impressed by Utica. Now, a number I wasn't quite clear on, what you said, 7,000 refugees are resettled or are are brought into the entire country in the year?
Every year, approximately, depends, 70,000 refugees, 70,000, are resettled to the United States through a very complex program, and they go to approximately 400 sites across the country.
Well, I wondered in that connection if, and you mentioned it's a very complex process, but you must have some insights about our resettlement policy or our immigration policy or our illegal immigration policy. I wonder if you have some insights on that that you'd care to share with us.
Full disclosure, Peter, you're talking to the press, but that's no. Our favorite editorial writer.
Yeah. I think we need fair, comprehensive, humane immigration reform. All right, that's what I believe. I think we need to make sure, yes, our borders are secure, that we're secure in knowing who's coming to live in the United States. But I think we need to have a policy and a program that enables people to come here legally, work here legally, participate in our economy, and that, I think, is critical to our future. Immigration is critical to our identity, is part of our identity, is part of who we are as a nation. Let's create those opportunities for people to actually be able to come legally so they don't find themselves forced into situations of coming undocumented. And I think that's foundational. And family is important. Family is critical to the success of immigration. The individuals, does that answer? It's a complex issue. It's a very complex question. But I think the refugee program is just a microcosm of a much larger program. 70,000 people is not that many relative to the total immigration of people into the United States. And that's relative to documented immigration. And then undocumented is a whole other issue.
Does that seem like a reasonable number?
70,000? When you put it in the context that there are 14 million refugees worldwide, 70,000 does not sound like a big number. We are, in spite of that, we as a nation resettle the most people, more people than any other country in the world. All right. So, but relative to the total displacement, people who have found themselves fleeing their home, sometimes in the middle of the night with nothing but the shirt on their back, 70,000 is a drop in the number in the bucket.
Yes, according to what you're saying and this influx of immigrants, my basic question is, how has it affected women's participation in society? I know this country has had a tremendous change and growth as our women are elected to office, part of our society. How has this immigration policy changed Utica, and how has it affected the participation of women?
You're talking about the refugee program itself?
Not particularly.
Oh, okay. We're getting a whole other subject here that I'm no expert at, I can tell you that much. I think it's, and this may sound cliche, it's important for us, and I'm a male here, you have to understand that, okay? It's important for us to embrace our new neighbors and figure out their traditions and their backgrounds, right? And help them understand our traditions and our backgrounds and find those commonalities. And let me give you why I say that. Is I lived in the Middle East for 20 years. I know many, many, many women who wear the hijab. The power and the strength and the focus that they have in their lives is amazing to see. Yet we sometimes project what we believe power and focus needs to be based on our values and our cultural traditions. So let's find where those commonalities are, embrace those commonalities, and shape each other in our knowledge about each other. It's too easy to focus on what is different and what separates us and what keeps us apart. It's very easy to do that. It's much more challenging. It takes a lot more patience, a lot more time and energy to focus on what is common between us. What values do we share? What things do we want to see for our children in our future? And if we focus on that, amazing things can happen. But if we focus on what makes us different, then we just like two icebergs in the sea, we just push them apart.
Peter, we've talked about refugees and the immigrants. And refugee is a very specific population, as you said, controlled by State Department and the numbers. But as you've had success as a refugee resettlement community and center, has that then translated into more immigration, more immigrants, that is, you know, people who have more different entry or coming from a different community, they were refugees someplace else and now they're immigrants. Have you seen an influx of immigrants also into the Utica area?
Absolutely. We're a poor little agency that don't have a lot of resources, but our best guess is that we've resettled about 14,000 people into Utica in a city of 60,000. Our best guess is that about 25% of those have out-migrated to other regions of the country. But we've seen another 25% in-migrate from places like Kentucky and Tennessee and from Ohio and from Syracuse. And so, you know, we've had people, we've had people move, right, to Utica. What is their motivating factor for coming? It's probably very complex, and you couldn't put your finger on just a single thing. But we have a reputation. And in the immigrant community, Utica has an amazing reputation for a place that you can come and be. I had someone from Philadelphia come up the other day, they were amazed. They were walking down the streets, and they work with refugees in Philadelphia. So, you know, if I walk down the street in Philadelphia, I can't pick out a refugee. I know who they are because I see the person. They work in the refugee center. I can't pick them up because they begin to change their clothes. They begin to dress in like all the rest of us are dressing, so they don't necessarily stick out. I said, but in Utica, they all still wear their traditional clothing, and they're walking down the streets dressed. Now, on the one hand, this can be a little problematic for some individuals, but on the other hand, they have the comfort level to be themselves in our community. That's beautiful. And so, you know, there's many different pull factors. Weather is sometimes a push factor. I'll tell you, someone who comes from a very warm climate, it takes them a long time to figure out that even though the sun's out, it's 20 degrees outside, right? Flip-flops don't go very far. But most people walk to our center. And so what we actually have people calling from the community. And I get all the phone calls. I don't know who gets phone calls in Syracuse, but I get all the phone calls, which is not good sometimes, but my family gets a little upset. I saw this guy walking down the street, it's 20 degrees outside and wearing flip-flops. Well, what happened is they had their house up to 70-some degrees in their house, comfortable and warm, sun's out, they walk outside, and there's a mile walk to the center. Well, your body temperature is warm. You know, you can handle being outside for 20 minutes, right? You get halfway to the center, suddenly you start freezing. Now I have a choice. Do I keep going to the center? I'm halfway there, or do I go back to my house and get my coat and my boots and my? And we see this all the time. And then the neighbor who's living, you know, they don't have shoes, they don't have boots. They have boots. They have these things. Just conceptually, it takes them a year or two to figure out that we got to dress warmly.
We all have that problem sometime in adjusting. Peter, I want to thank you, Peter Vogelaar from the Mohawk Valley. Thank you, and you know we're going to be after you all year.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.